my hope is that our members have time to go into the budget and actually look at programs that work, those that may not work.
Under a new rule in the State House, it will be all budget all the time. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the city of Anchorage buys a larger stake in a Cook Inlet gas field.
It's about making sure we have a stable, secure price of energy and affordability and availability of energy.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Elder Mentor Program is about sharing the wisdom and culture of Alaskan elders in classrooms and communities across Alaska. Elders age 55 and older bring storytelling and modeling of appropriate behavior to the next generation. Earn a small stipend while supporting educational professionals and children. Alaska's Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Lawmakers have talked about focusing on the state budget since their session began 3 weeks ago, but today they took action to make it official. The House passed a resolution that limits committees to working on bills that raise or spend state revenue. This new rule will remain in place until the House passes a budget. House Speaker Mike Chenault, a Nikiski Republican, said putting a focus on the budget will allow legislators to be better informed about its details.
My hope is that our members have time to go into the budget and actually look at programs that work, those that may not work, have more time to talk with people in the departments to find out, more about that budget and be able to make better decisions based on the information that they have versus what they think they might have.
House Democrats raised concerns that the rule change would also allow the public to be notified about bills the night before a hearing rather than the normal 5-day notice. But only one House member, Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson, voted against the resolution. The Senate is unlikely to make a similar change, according to Senate President Kevin Meyer, an Anchorage Republican. Meyer noted that it's a small chamber with only 20 members instead of 40. He added that the House will pass the budget first, giving the Senate time to consider other legislation. In addition to the rule changes, there was another proposal today to revise how the legislature functions this session. Democratic members from both the House and Senate proposed all legislators meet as a caucus of the whole. They said this would allow them to provide input before the Republicans in the majority advance the budget. Senate Minority Leader Berta Gardner, an Anchorage Democrat, said the change would encourage all lawmakers to work together.
When the chips are down and the situation is urgent, we've always come through, shedding our identities as Republicans or Democrats, and remembering that in our core, we are Alaskans first, we are Alaskans together.
Senate President Kevin Meyer said he'd consider the proposal, but wants more details about what the Democrats are looking for.
We are going to need bipartisan support on passing any tax bills, and that's true, but also we are going to need their help on budget reductions, and that topic hasn't come up yet.
The House canceled all hearings on bills that weren't related to the budget today. The city of Anchorage is buying up part of a natural gas field in Cook Inlet for $152 million. With approval from the Assembly, the mayor's administration and two utility companies bought a parcel from a major oil company, which they say will benefit energy customers across the city. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, it's uncommon for a municipal utility to own a natural gas source, but not without precedent.
During a quick press conference at City Hall, Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz broke the news that after months of closed-door meetings, the city has worked out a deal to buy a section of the Beluga River unit owned by ConocoPhillips.
We're excited about the prospect. We think it heralds a new time in terms of Anchorage's energy future. It's about making sure we have a stable, secure price of energy and affordability and availability of energy.
This isn't new for Anchorage. It's actually just another big chunk of the parcel they acquired back in 1996, at the same site, actually. Since then, the city's electrical utility, MLNP, says it saved more than $200 million by owning the gas instead of buying it from someone else. This latest purchase means the municipality now owns 2/3 of the lease, with the last portion held by Hillcorp. But unlike the deal 2 decades ago, this one involves the Chugach Electric Association Co-op and is designed to save money for ratepayers not just in the Anchorage Bowl, but spread further across South Central.
It's also about signaling that Chugach and MLNP are going to work together closely to make sure we can deliver the best for all of our ratepayers.
Berkowitz said he'd done a back-of-the-envelope calculation of savings for his own electric bill that penciled out to a couple $100s a year. The companies say the customer savings could be substantial. Chugach thinks its new stake will save the company $2 to $3 million a year. MLNP estimates $4 to $6 million a year. The lease is one of two ConocoPhillips holdings in Cook Inlet that the company is shedding. Spokesperson Amy Burnett says Conoco is putting more emphasis on its North Slope holdings.
So the Blueger River unit is a historical asset and has been historically an important part of the ConocoPhillips portfolio, but it is a mature asset and it really no longer fits into our portfolio. And the sale of the asset actually allows us to focus on higher growth areas.
Translation, we're not making much money off it, which if you're a private company means one thing, but for a municipal utility, you don't need as wide a profit margin.
It makes financial sense for MLNP and Chugach.
Larry Persily is the oil and gas advisor for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. He says that, of course, there are some financial risks, but the acquisition is basically just scaling up a program that, by all measures, has worked well for the utility and its ratepayers the last 20 years.
I guess I trust that they've looked at the numbers pretty closely, and they're not going to pay more for a larger share of Beluga gas field than they would pay if they had to buy it from other producers somewhere else.
As for whether it's normal for a city like Anchorage to vertically integrate a gas field, Persily says it's not unusual, but it's not that common either. The financial structure of the deal, a mix of cash and bonds, is not yet finalized and will need approval by the assembly. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Division of Insurance announced an agreement with insurer Moda Health today that will allow the company to stay on the individual and group market in Alaska. Division Director Lori Wing-Hire says Moda's CEO signed the consent agreement this weekend.
We've worked very hard to get to this agreement to protect consumers, but also to get them back into the marketplace to take care of those that enjoyed doing business with Moda, to provide competition on the exchange, and that the company doing business is solvent.
The agreement requires Moda to sell some assets to raise capital. The company will also have to establish a reserve account in Alaska with $15 million to pay claims if Moda runs into financial trouble again. Late last month, Alaska and Oregon placed Moda under supervision and suspended the company from selling plans because of excessive operating losses. At that time, the company thought it would have to exit Alaska's individual market. Jason Godey is director of Alaska Sales and Service for Moda.
Our first thought on that was in order to remain financially sound, it was going to be a necessary step that we would have to take. But we were able to work out a deal with the regulators in Alaska and Oregon to maintain the individual market in those two states for at least the rest of 2016, which I think is certainly a win for consumers.
Godey says it's too soon to tell whether the company can continue on Alaska's individual market for 2017. Moda is working with Primera Alaska on a plan to stabilize rates on the state's individual market. That proposal will require legislative action. The open enrollment period for individual plans on healthcare.gov closed on January 31st. Wing-Hire says she's asking the federal government to open a 2-week special enrollment period to accommodate Alaskans who couldn't buy Moda plans.
We know there are people that had finished their enrollment but then got to a point where they could not pay or could not finalize it. And for those people that are still kind of in a limbo, we're hoping that CMS will give us a 2-week period, a 2-week special enrollment to allow those people to finalize and choose Moda as their insurer.
Wing-Hire says if Moda does not follow through on the consent agreement, Oregon will put the company into receivership. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Dillingham Police Department deploys new body cams on every officer.
We wanted to reduce complaints, document evidence, and record videos of crime scenes.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The city of Angoon believes high levels of mercury have been discovered in subsistence food caught near Hawk Inlet, and they say Hecla's Greens Creek mine could be responsible. Angoon's tribal government is asking for changes with monitoring and processing of mine waste. Albert Howard, the city's mayor and tribal president, said dead crab initiated the concern. Last year, a seal was harvested at Hawk Point and brought back to the village to share. Howard said a sample of the tissue was sent to a lab to be inspected.
And the lab results came back as one of the highest levels of mercury seen in the state of Alaska, as far as since the seal sampling program has taken place.
Howard said the Friends of Admiralty Island has also found elevated toxic metals in seaweed, clams, mussels, shrimp, cockles, and crab. It's such a concern that Angoon has warned tribal members not to collect traditional foods in the area. Howard said he would like to see the city and the mine work together to clean up the water.
I understand that the mine is important to a lot of people for jobs and you know, revenue into the city and borough of Juneau, but there's also a responsibility of the community health here. And what I meant by that is that the city council and the tribal councils understand the importance of the health of our community members and our children.
Mike Satry, Greens Creek's spokesperson, said the mine reports a sample on an annual basis.
I'm saying that we meet all of the permitted conditions that are put on us by the state for the discharge of our water into Hawk Inlet.
While the reports are annual, Satry says they're based on continuous monitoring and sampling of the discharge water, and they're supplemented by quarterly biomonitoring and additional sampling of seawater and sediment. Angoon has requested that Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott and Alaska's Department of Health and Social Services look into the matter. A string of recent incidents involving police force have led many Americans to demand measures like equipping officers with body cameras. Some departments, including Dillingham's, have already begun to do so voluntarily. KDLG's Hannah Colton has the story.
Like people 30 and under in workplaces everywhere, Officer Tanner Lowry is labeled the tech-savvy one by default.
Since I'm the younger one, so, you know, technology is a little bit more, you know, my thing, just because.
So when the Dillingham Police Department got a batch of 4 new wearable video cameras last month, it was Lowry they called on to help get them set up.
Turn on. It's just a flip of the switch, and it just takes like half a second to turn on, and then it vibrates, and then a little red light's on to indicate to me that it's on.
The 1.5 by 3 inch camera sits Velcroed on the center of Lowry's chest, sandwiched between a flashlight and a handheld radio. The camera is actually one of the smallest things he has strapped on his vest. And Lowry says the new cameras, at $250 a piece, are much better than the $80 models DPD was using when he got here 2 years ago.
They were smaller. They were difficult to understand if they were on or not. They had just had one blinking light. In the dark, it was just pitch black. You couldn't see anything. These ones come with a light, so you can actually see pretty well in the night with them. The camera quality is better.
Of course, Lowry says there are still limitations. Since the camera's on his chest and not, say, attached to a pair of glasses, it's not going to see what he's seeing if he turns his head. But Police Chief Dan Pascarello says the cameras are a step up from the department's long-standing practice of audio recording.
We've always documented our interviews and our contacts with audio.
In his 20-plus years at the department, Pascarello's seen the technology shift from microcassettes to digital audio recorders, and finally, a couple years ago, to digital video cameras.
We decided to get body cameras for the same reason a lot of police departments in America are going to body cameras, to visually document police activity and our interactions with the public. We wanted to reduce complaints, document evidence, and record videos of crime scenes.
Time magazine reported last month that of the 18,000 local and state police departments in the nation, nearly a third of them are in the process of putting body cameras on their officers. In big city police departments, like the LAPD, for example, the transition is expected to take millions of dollars and dozens of new staff to keep up with video storage. But for a small department like Dillingham's, it's an easy enough task. Each of the 8 officers is responsible for offloading his own videos onto one big external hard drive at the end of each day. For Officer Lowry, the 20 minutes of extra work is well worth the peace of mind he gets with having proof of his behavior on the job.
It's actually really helpful when you're in situations and you have someone who's saying you did something bad that, you know, is not really right, and you're like, I didn't do that, and you have something to prove that you didn't do what they say you did.
The video clips stay in their neatly organized files indefinitely, or until they get handed over to the district attorney's office. Asked whether members of the public can request to see the videos, Pascarello indicated that has not been the department's practice.
We just release the videos as discovery in criminal cases.
4 of DPD's officers have been getting used to the new cameras for a couple months now. The other 4 are slated for an upgrade this week. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Coulton.
Many people think the Alaska Marine Highway System only serves port communities in the southeast and southwest parts of the state, plus Prince William Sound. It turns out that it has economic impacts in the rail belt, too. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Juneau-based research business, the McDowell Group, created the report at the request of the state. It lists Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough among the top hometowns for residents booking ferry travel. And Anchorage is tied for first as the prime destination for ferrying summer tourists.
The Marine Highway System, it has this invisible role, you know, in the rest of the state that's not as apparent.
Heather Hoagland wrote the McDowell Group report based on 2014 fiscal year information. It shows the ferry system to be an essential part of Alaska's economic landscape. The Marine Highway employs about 1,000 people directly, which leads to almost 700 other jobs in retail, tourism, and other industries. The report, released February 4th, also shows the system brings in about $270 million a year, more than twice the amount the state spends on operations and maintenance. Hoagland says that includes about $65 million in ferry workers' pay.
Those wages, in turn, get spent elsewhere in the state, and that creates indirect and induced impacts. And the businesses, as well, that Marine Highway System works with and makes purchases from, they, in turn, make additional purchases.
Of course, the Marine Highway's biggest impacts are on smaller, isolated communities. Their residents depend on ferry travel for medical care, shopping, and school trips.
The Marine Highway System serves 33 communities, and only 5 of them are connected to the road system.
The report says the Marine Highway carried almost 320,000 passengers and more than 100,000 vehicles in the year studied. More than 4,000 container vans carried groceries and seafood, as well as other products. Hoagland says those are especially important in small communities with few other options.
You can't just replace the ferry system with air. The air travel, there's a lot of canceled flights. There's not as much capacity on air. So it just plays such an essential role in many facets of life in these really small communities.
The report is based on information from the fiscal year beginning in July of 2013. But the schedule has been cut since then, and more reductions are planned due to the state's budget crisis. Hoagland says economic and other impacts will drop proportionately as sailings and ships are cut. Ferry system spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the new study replaces older information.
There has been requests from the public and I believe the legislature as well to look at this economic impact and renew the study information.
Woodrow says the study has been sent to coastal legislators as well as members of the House and Senate Transportation Committees. This is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Brent Sass is leading the Yukon Quest. He is followed by Hugh Neff, Ed Hopkins, Alan Moore, and Matt Hall. The next section of trail takes teams along the Yukon River to the community of Eagle. Yesterday, Quest mushers made the daunting traverse of Eagle Summit. KUAC's Molly Reddig has more.
It was crystal clear on Eagle Summit on Sunday afternoon. White domes popped up in every direction, and the sun reflected off the wind-blasted snow. But there was hardly a hint of breeze. Every once in a while, the silence was broken by the scratch of sled runners and heavy panting.
Good dog, come by.
Then a dog team appeared, coming over the hill.
Good dog.
And behind
good
them,
dog.
On the back of a sled, was a musher in a heavy coat. Before the climb, many were camping out and resting at mile 101 of the Steese Highway. Paige Drobny kneeled in the snow and removed lunch items from a cooker. Pizza, noodles, and energy drink. Her dogs were curled up in piles of straw while her husband, Cody Strath, stood nearby, eating reheated pizza. They were both getting ready to tackle the 3,600-foot mountain. The downhill can be particularly sketchy.
It's like a 10-story freefall. It's pretty gnarly. It's not anything anyone should do on a dog team.
Drobny had a bad crash there 4 years ago.
I tipped the sled right at the top, and my headlamp and hat went flying at the top, and my whole right side was bruised from elbow to knee.
So this year, she added some extra brakes.
Chains to wrap around my runners to slow me down, and I'll probably undo some tugs, and then just try to keep it upright.
The checkpoint was located in a snowy field surrounded by mountains. Outside, about a dozen teams were bedded down sleeping. There were a few warm cabins where mushers could catch a couple hours of rest before returning to the trail. Good smells wafted out from one of them. Inside, volunteers were cooking a hearty breakfast. Four mushers sat over plates of scrambled eggs and bacon. Gaetan Pirard was just finishing up. The rookie musher had an exciting start to the race.
I nearly lost my team because I broke the line.
About 3 hours from the start, he hit a tree and snapped the main line connecting all the dogs to the sled.
There was two trees. It was a zigzag. I avoided the first one and then I hit the second one.
It took him about 20 minutes to fix as three teams zoomed by. But the race calmed down after that.
I think I gained confidence on that one instead of the opposite, so it's good.
Ed Hopkins was outside putting red booties on his dogs, who were waking up from a nap. The Canadian musher had a scare on day one as well.
I lost a dog.
The dog, named Malkin, actually belongs to his wife, and he's always had a mischievous streak. As Hopkins was leaving camp Sunday morning, he noticed he had an empty spot on his line.
I looked down the trail, and there's a dog running down the trail, and it wouldn't come to me.
He followed him down the trail until they caught up with another musher. Then Malkin did a U-turn and started running in the opposite direction, back toward Fairbanks. The other musher, J.J. Levy, stood on Hopkins' snow hook while he chased down the loose dog.
Finally caught him.
With all his dogs back, Hopkins was hoping to make up some time on the leaders. Matt Hall, one of the favorites, already ran past his home in Two Rivers. He was a little behind the leaders because he took a long break before Eagle Summit. He let the dogs rest for 5 hours, while he managed to grab about one solid hour of sleep. Hall said he was surprised how fast the leaders took off this year, but he doesn't want to get into race mode too early.
It's hard, but I'm trying to stick with the plan I came up with, because that's the plan that we've trained for, and it's not really ideal to just jump and run and chase.
He's dropped two dogs so far, who weren't feeling great.
Definitely down to my 12 best in the whole kennel right now.
On Sunday night, mushers ate burgers at the lodge in Central, and some watched the Super Bowl while their dogs rested. Every once in a while, a musher lined up their team in the dark and headed back on the trail. On the Yukon Quest Trail and Circle, I'm Molly Reddig.
There's a long tradition of trapping fur-bearing animals in Bristol Bay, and one group of Dillingham youngsters has been learning the ropes this winter. KDLG's Molly Dishner met them at the trap line and brought back this story.
The 4-H Trapping Club is part practical outdoor skills, part comedy club, part King of the Mountain. On a recent Thursday night, I tagged along as they pulled their traps. The group had 8 traps set along a creek off Kanakanak. The sun was setting when we walked across frozen tundra to check them.
We'll just go by feel here. It's still set. If we were just checking, then it's okay. Nothing in there. cover the whole back up if we have snow.
That's Andy Aderman. He and Joe Stallmaster are the group's leaders. Aderman has been trapping since he was 5, younger than the crew he's been teaching this winter. Most of the traps are covered in ice, and it takes some chopping to get the metal device back out. We come across one that's a little bit easier.
I think we might have lucked out and not have much chopping to do here.
No chopping at all.
This is all? Come on. Zach, you good?
All right, let me see.
Four, three, two, one, do it, Zach, do it.
All right.
None of the traps have anything in them tonight, but sixth grader Noah Sage tells me what they've found on other outings.
A beaver, two otter, and mink.
When they're not chipping away at an icy creek, or playing King of the Beaver Lodge, as the case may be, the boys learn what to do with the animals they've caught in a garage off Lake Road. Noah tells me about the lesson at hand.
We are stretching our mink, and I think it's called fleshing too.
A couple weeks earlier, they skinned the minks, using a knife to separate the skin from the inside. Sixth grader Reese Bennis says that included the grossest part.
When we're cutting the mink, there's this part where the poop comes out, and it stinks. Most of the times, you'll accidentally cut it.
Now, Aderman explains how to use a hog scraper to clean off the skin.
So you got them inside out, got the feet pulled out. What we're trying to do is get rid of this little bit of fat. They're especially fatty down here on their on their belly. They also have what's called a saddle that's on their shoulders. This stuff, normally when you're doing these for the fur market where you're going to sell them, you leave that, you can trim a little bit of that. That fat and that thicker muscle off, and then they recommend you just leave the rest of it.
Once scraped, the furs are pinned to stretchers to dry out. Getting them ready, it's been a meticulous process and a little bit tedious.
You still got a lot to go.
You still got a lot to go.
But in a room full of preteen boys, there's always something to laugh about.
Mom's so stupid, she put 2 quarters in her ear and she thought she was listening to 50 Cent.
That one's old.
The boys know. It takes a thick skin to be a Bristol Bay fur trapper. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Elizabeth Jenkins and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Hannah Colton and Molly Dishner in Dillingham, and Molly Reddig on the Yukon Quest Trail. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Raven Alaska, offering passenger, cargo, and same-day package delivery to over 100 communities across Alaska. Find more at flyraven.com.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.